Hi, I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is the A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the popular books and movies they love and look for the one reality they see underneath.
That's right. And this is episode number 14, and we're going to talk about Groundhog Day, a movie starring Bill Murray and Andy McDowell.
A favorite. I, you know, if there's anybody who hasn't seen this and would have to stop at the spoiler section, I can't imagine who it would be. Hasn't everyone in America seen this one?
I think so.
Yeah. Yeah,
and it's a movie that struck me when I watched it. And then, you know, every time I watch it, you know, you get something else out of it. It's a terrific movie. I've got a really neat quote that I found on the DVD extra, the DVD that I have. By Harold Ramis said this. He was being interviewed, and Harold Ramis was the director slash writer. And he said, someone called me and said the Buddhists love this movie. Then I met a yogi who said, oh, this is a yoga movie. It totally expresses our philosophy. Then I started getting letters from Jesuits, from fundamentalist Christians, all saying the same thing. You must be one of us because this movie perfectly expresses our philosophy of life. And so that's kind of been his experience with the movie.
Yeah, it's interesting because I listened to the Stephen Tobolowsky, is that
his name? Oh, yes, yeah.
File on this episode. And he's the guy who played Ned Ryan.
Ned Ryerson.
Ryerson. Yep. I can't even remember the name. Uh-huh. Ned Ryerson. And he was talking about how it started off as a very typical 80s comedy and turned into something else. And when he said that, I suddenly reoriented my thinking about it because I had always looked at it as something else because I saw the finished product. And when he told about watching the progress and seeing the point when suddenly they took a more serious turn with the overall message, I said, oh yeah, this could have been one of those little toss-offs that no one remembers.
Oh, for sure. You know, it could have been a bleak black and white, in the hands of different people, I guess is what I'm saying. It could have been a very serious, bleak movie.
It could have been, yes, German or Swedish. Or on the other hand, it could have been just stupid. They could have just let... It could have been like, the John Belushi movie, Animal House, where you could have, I suppose, done something else with that. But it's one of those movies that you remember fondly and you go back and look at and go, whoa, so sophomoric. You know, it was of the time that you viewed it in your life and in that cultural period.
Right.
And this transcends that. And it's interesting because I know this movie so well. I thought, oh, I haven't watched it in so long. And we watched it and I was like, yes, I practically have every line memorized from when I watched it so many times before. But what that did was it left me free to say, wow, Bill Murray was doing a much more subtle job of acting than I ever realized.
Yeah, and he was. I realized the same thing as watching it this time around. You watch things with different eyes and it really is incredible. I mean, he did a fantastic job in this movie.
Yeah, it was because it's a comedy and there are so many broad moments, you kind of look at those if you're not thinking about it. But when you're just looking at it going, wow, do I know this movie well? His expression changes are subtle, but they communicate so much of his experience internally. And I was stunned.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
The little DVD extra, it was like a 20-minute DVD extra on the DVD that I had, which is where I got that quote. And then listening to that Tobolowsky podcast, and we'll put a link to that podcast in the show notes.
Yeah, it's great.
It's called the Tobolowsky Files, and it's terrific.
Oh, that's it.
It's terrific. Yeah. Anyway, but some of the things that they did when they were filming it, like they had to worry about the same day. Do we need to describe this movie?
Yeah, or are we just going to assume? Just, you know what? In case there's somebody in Poland listening.
Okay, maybe we better. Okay.
Sorry.
No, it's fine. What it's about is Bill Murray plays this weatherman who is very stuck up, very full of himself. He's a complete jerk. Yeah, he's and he is being sent to cover Groundhog Day in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't really want to. You know, this is a hick town. It's full of people that he's sure that he doesn't like. And he's better than this. He doesn't need to be doing this kind of thing because he's way better than this kind of stuff.
He has dreams of doing network news or weather someday.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So they get there. They cover this Groundhog Day. And, you know, he has pretty much a crappy day of his own making because he's a jerk, like I said. And then when he goes to sleep that night, he wakes up and it's Groundhog Day again. And he relives the same day over again. And then he relives the day over and over and over and over and over. And that's the premise of the movie.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny because one of the things they talked about that I realized more this time when I was watching it, thinking about this podcast, and that Steve Tobolowsky talks about is they never tell you why.
Yeah,
I never heard why. When I watched it the first time, I just kind of, you get pulled into the fact that what is he going to do with his life now that this day he can't get out of it? He's in eternity, basically.
Yeah, and I definitely wanted to talk about that because this is a science fiction movie, wouldn't you say?
I guess,
because of the premise, you know, just because of the premise. Fantasy. But if it was real science fiction.
Or horror,
yeah. If it was real science fiction, they would take some time to explain what is causing it would have been a big part of the story.
Maybe it's like a Stephen King book, mm-hmm. Because that's the thing. If you took it and I could see it being an episode of The Twilight Zone.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so-and-so wakes up.
sure.
Bill Collins.
Yeah, and then, you know, in The Twilight Zone, they never, ever, well, I mean, often they did, but often right. They did not. They just said, that's The right. Twilight Zone, you know.
But because this is left open, and what you see is, as time goes by, he has to deal with it, and what is he going to do with his life? How's he going to interact with all the people in it when it's the same mm-hmm. thing day after day after
yeah,
day?
Yeah, and the fact, to me, the fact that they did leave that open and they did not explain it, because Tobolowsky seemed to suggest that they did attempt to in a previous script.
Right.
But the fact that they left that open and they didn't explain it is probably part of the reason why Buddhists love the movie and the yogi loved it and the fundamentalist Christian loves it and the Jesuit, you know, everybody's seeing that they're able to fill that in.
Yeah.
You know,
it's
they're just filling it in
that way.
Yeah. So I think that was a great choice.
And I would venture to say probably, you know, I could see, you know, atheists going, oh, it's, you know, humans can improve themselves and I think it's mm-hmm. got something to say for everybody that way.
Oh, it sure does. Yeah. I agree with you. Yeah.
But people of faith, especially.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like, if you haven't seen it, huge spoiler.
Yep.
At the end, he's yanked out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And you, well, I guess that's not a huge spoiler, but you know, you're only watching the movie to see if he will get out of it. Mm-hmm. And at the end, he's yanked out of it and he's a different person.
Yeah. And I think probably the reason that it appeals to religious folks so much is because of the conclusion that he came to after going through all this is the conclusion that we teach, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, it's selflessness. Is that how you'd put it?
Yeah. You have to look outside of yourself and give to others for your life to have any real meaning and for you to really be happy because mm-hmm. Catholics will say that's what we're made for.
Mm-hmm.
That's the example Christ gave us. And
right.
It's counterintuitive because you don't want to. Mm-hmm. You want to have the biggest piece of cake. You want to, you know. And Bill Murray exemplifies that. He's selfish. He makes fun of everybody else. And it's interesting because Andy McDowell is the perfect counterpoint. She shows exactly what he should be, or a regular person should be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not shown any of her flaws. If she has a flaw, she's a little too optimistic.
Yeah.
You know, he comes around the park and they're doing, playing that polka song. And she's like, isn't this great? People spend the night out here. They go to the fire and get warm. And then they sing some more. And you're just like, wow, I'm not sure I could be cheerful like that in the morning. But she's ready for any kind of fun.
Yeah.
Good, wholesome fun.
That's right. That's right. So Bill Murray's first reaction to this is, of course, you know, what the heck is going on here? And then once he realizes that he's going to be there for a while, and that's another thing, that we're never sure how long he's in this day, but it is a very long time.
Yeah.
It's got to be a very long time.
It's funny. They say that's the question everybody asks, and that had never occurred to me until we were talking about it with somebody years ago who said, I wonder how many years was he there? And I was like, oh, because he does a lot of stuff.
Yeah, he does a lot of stuff. But yeah, once he realizes that he's going to be stuck there, or he is stuck there, you know, so 4 or 5 days in, he starts to enjoy himself. You know, he can smoke, he can eat things, he can insult people. I mean, it doesn't make any difference because he's got no consequences. That's the first thing that he realizes.
I know, it was like, it's almost like 5 or 6, you know, how they always used to say there's those steps when you die, the, you know, acceptance, anger, whatever it is, that's the wrong order. I started writing it down because I was like, it's like, one is fear, two is there's no consequences, so it's hedonism.
Mm-hmm.
Three, then he goes to despair.
Yeah.
But despair is when... But it's interesting because once he's been there and he hits despair, that's when he's been faking it and trying to get Rita. And that's Andy McDowell's character, his love interest.
Mm-hmm.
If you could say that he could love anyone.
Right, right. Not at first he couldn't.
Mm-mm.
Yeah, it was only when he learned that things started to change for him.
When he was around her all the time.
Yeah, yeah. So he's, you know, around those two every single day. And, you know, and it's a hilarious movie as well. There's, you know, all the stuff that he does, you know, is funny.
We're not making it sound hilarious, I guess.
We're not. We're making it sound.
It's early Bill Murray. He was so young.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was way after Caddyshack, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. After Caddyshack, after Saturday Night Live. But, yeah. Yep. But again, that's... You know, this entire path that he takes, I think, is where the depth comes from. And it's always interesting to wonder, was it accidental depth, or did they really know what they were doing, you know, when they were doing it?
Well, in that podcast, and this is, of course, only from that actor's point of view, but Stephen Tobolowsky says that there was supposed to be a scene where he realizes there are no consequences, and so he trashes his hotel room and puts his hair in a mohawk and... Mm-hmm. All this stuff, and then he wakes up and the day is the same again.
Yeah.
And that was total chaos. And they looked at that scene, which was very expensive, and then went, nope, that's the wrong direction, threw it out, and then did the scene where he breaks the pencil.
Mm-hmm.
And then he wakes up the next morning and the pencil is whole again.
Yeah.
And they said that's when they kind of started taking a more thoughtful look at it. Because... That and that's what he starts to learn all along. It is hilarious, but underneath the depths are that he has to face himself. He has to face the fact that hedonism isn't enough. Because then he starts trying to kill himself.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's like, that's it. I'm getting out. So he makes a suicide attempt, and he wakes up the next morning. He's like, oh man. And it's painful to watch. I mean,
it's really painful to watch.
He's killing himself way after, I mean, you know, the toaster in the water, jumping off a building. And I'm just like, wow, no matter how many times he does this, he's still experiencing it each time. That hurts.
Mm-hmm.
And
he comes out of that experience saying, I am a god.
Right. I put that down as step four, delusions of godhood.
That's funny. Yeah, but that's an interesting conclusion to come to. And then he's explaining that to Andy McDowell, you know, I am a god. And she says, no. What would she say? I went to Catholic school.
It's 12 years of Catholic school talking here.
I'm pretty sure you're not a god.
I know, and I never thought about it because I never took that seriously, but mm-hmm. I was thinking about it for the podcast, and I was like, well, no, because then you'd be able to get out of the day, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you sure would, yeah.
But at some point along there is he starts trying to manipulate Rita into getting her into bed with him.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that I thought was interesting is he's never able to do it because at some different point as he recreates what's a perfect day, it gets more and more fake. But even from the beginning, she can sense something fake in him.
Mm-hmm.
And she's not going to give herself to somebody who isn't genuine and doesn't really love her.
Right.
So even when she thinks she's been misguided and here's the real person that's been hiding underneath the whole time, she finally tells him, I can't love you because you'll never love anyone but yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's when he hits despair. When she says that to him is when he starts trying. He's like, that's it. I'm worthless. My life is worth nothing. I've been found out and I've had it told to me.
Yeah.
And so I'll start trying to kill myself. And then he goes into the delusions of godhood. He stops trying to manipulate her and he starts actually appreciating her for who she is.
Right. Yeah. Once he gets through that despair and his attempts at suicide don't work because he continually wakes up anyway, then things change. And he starts to realize what, you know, almost by accident, he just gives up. And when he lets go is when things start to go well for him.
Yeah. When he starts caring about Rita genuinely.
Yeah. When he lets go of himself, really, I guess is what I'm saying. Yeah. So yeah. He stops caring, you know, about himself.
Yeah. Because that's not getting him anything. And he suddenly, and I think it's, he has this thing where he actually confides in everything in Rita and he's just honest because there's nothing to be gained from manipulation. And so she says, okay, well, I'll stay with you and spend the night and we'll break the spell basically.
Mm-hmm.
And she's just, you know, they're doing things like talking or playing games or, you know, like card games, throwing things like that. And, she falls asleep and he suddenly starts telling her, because it's safe, all the things that he has noticed that make her a good person.
Mm-hmm.
And so not only do we see more of what she's like and he sees those things to admire, but that's the point when he stops holding on to himself because nothing's going to ever change. And he starts not only looking at Rita, but he looks at the world around him, because I was intrigued by the fact that that's also when he gets nicer to Chris Elliott's character, who's the cameraman, who he just treats as a serf before that. And suddenly he's, you know, bringing coffee the way they like it and asking his opinion on where they should shoot it and genuinely being nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he's nice to the whole town too.
Right.
He, you know, when they first got there, you know, when Andy was saying, yeah, they're going to come back and dance again. And he says, well, they're hicks, Rita.
At the beginning of that,
yeah. But he starts to change his mind about all those folks, too. And he spends time, you know, there are some people who die during that day or get hurt during that day. And as, you know, the years pass and he's living this day over and over, he finds out, you know, what in this town happens, and he tries to save him.
He realizes life is precious. And so it starts with the old homeless man who he is like, I am not going to let you die today. Mm-hmm. Well, he can't stop that.
Right. He wasn't able to stop that. And that's an interesting comment, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sometimes people just die. It's their time.
Mm-hmm. And then a kid fell out of a tree. You come catch him. You never say thank you.
But I think that's after the program of self-improvement that he goes on.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
First, he finally says he does the thing that we all would do. We all say we'd like to do. If we all had the time, he starts learning to play the piano. You see him thoughtfully reading things and musing on them. Mm-hmm. He was working on his French, learning ice sculpture.
Yeah.
All, you know, whatever the town affords him in that one day.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting that after he does that and he starts looking around him more is when he suddenly says, oh, well, wait a minute. Because he's not, he doesn't hate himself so much either. He's had to love himself first. And I think some of that self-improvement was giving himself a chance to prove he could do those things. He had more potential than he was giving himself credit for.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't just a weatherman.
Yeah, so in Catholic philosophy, I mean, it almost seems contradictory what we've said, that the selflessness, and then you mentioned that he loved himself, and that changed him.
Oh, that's a good point.
So how, in Catholic philosophy, I know in Buddhism, selflessness is really what they like to attain, right? They want to attain... material things have no effect on me. You know, I appreciate what I have. I don't want for anything I don't have. And therefore it has no control over me.
Which is a Catholic ideal also, but yeah. not put forward as such a central tenet, if I'm right. And if there are people out there who know more, please, you know, mm-hmm. I don't know. So.
Yeah, but I do know that selflessness is a prized value in Catholicism as well. You know, the asceticism of so many of the saints and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Giving of the self for other people.
Yeah, and the thing is everybody doesn't have to learn piano to mm-hmm. love yourself. That's just, those are the outward signs of his inward change.
So when you say, you know, love yourself, you're talking about,
it's
really like yourself is out of the way. That's what I got out of the movie. Yourself is not preventing you from moving forward. And I guess if you hated yourself, it would be.
Well, and the thing is
because you're like constantly acting, I guess.
Well, and I'm trying to think, I think what it is more is having a proper, I'm just trying to think about, because I kind of went through this. I mean, I used to be a very glasses half empty person. And I think I've talked about this before. You know, my hairdresser was like, you're so different now. You used to be, and she used some other word. And I said, hard. And she goes, yeah, I didn't want to use that word.
Hmm.
And we're good friends
mm-hmm.
in the stereotypic way. But, she is right. And I realized at some point that I had turned into a glasses half full kind of person, but it wasn't because I learned to love myself like I'm so great. It was because I had a proper perspective on who I was, that I was worth something. I was valuable as a person, that God loved me
mm-hmm.
or loves me, that because And look at who God is and look at who I am. And he knows all the bad things about me. And he loves me anyway because I'm still valuable anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
And these kind of sound like cliches, but maybe that's because they're repeated so often because they're true.
Yeah.
Because when you have that proper perspective of who you are in the world, that's when you, and who God is and where you belong, that's when you can say, oh, I am worth loving. Yeah, there's faults and there's flaws, but we all have them. But I am a decent, valuable person in and of myself. And then you can look at everybody else and go, oh, and because I'm not busy looking at everything in relationship to me of I'm so miserable, therefore I need this, or you're doing that and that makes me unhappy or whatever, then you can look at it and go, okay, I'm fine. I don't have to worry about what you think about me, or I don't have to do this to make myself feel better. I'm kind of detached from myself more
mm-hmm.
from my kind of that Buddhist idea of I'm detached from my selfish needs, the things to make me feel better and good. I already am closer to that. So I can look at how can I help you?
Yeah.
You're valuable too. Like I'm valuable. How can I help you be better? you know, save you from, give you a meal so maybe you don't die of the cold, catch you so you don't break your leg or you know, kill yourself, or and look at the pain your family's caused when you fall out of the tree or choke from the piece of meat or fix your tire. I mean, wouldn't that be the ultimate selflessness? And that's why we're supposed to be detached from things, because that, if you're attached to your things, then you also don't have a proper perspective. They're fine, but they're not what's the most important.
Yeah, and that's it. I think self-value is probably the way that I'd put that. When you do things in your life that make you, when you do things in life that are of value,
yeah,
and of value almost always means other people. It doesn't mean that you're trying to please other people, but it means that you're assisting other people in some way. That yeah. seems to be what is valuable, and I think that that's what he finds.
And I think that's why that speaks to people of all faiths, or because it's a basic tenet of humanity. We're kind of built that way, actually.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah,
I mean, Catholics would say that original sin kind of helps us skew away from it, just meaning that it's that flaw. It's kind of a built-in flaw of we have trouble finding the balance. We get too attached to other things. We get a wrong idea of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what knowing God helps you get away from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it puts you in touch with that need for selflessness in order for self-worth, I guess.
Right, or the loving mm-hmm. other people as much as you love yourself. And I don't mean like the emotion.
Mm-hmm.
I just mean, because you don't have to feel the emotion about it, but just the, what can I do to help you because you're having a hard time right at this moment?
Mm-hmm.
Or because this would be nice to do. You didn't say you needed it. You didn't know you needed it. But I happen to see that you're going to be off your feet for a couple of weeks. I'll just bring you a meal or whatever. Because I would like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you're worth it. You're a person.
Mm-hmm.
And you're my friend. So you're my life. So I'll do this for you. I was at a book club, this Catholic group of women who the other night, and one person, something got brought up about how we're all lonely from the book we were reading, Devil's mm-hmm. Advocate by Morris West. Really great. We're going to read it sometime.
All right.
And
sounds
just
good.
A little advance notice. But this same concept got brought up because somebody was saying that her mother-in-law is one of the most difficult people to be around. And oh my goodness, the stories. She is miserable. And she makes Bill Murray look like a saint at the beginning of the movie because she's just lashing out at everybody. And you could see she's miserable. And she says, the daughter-in-law says, well, she's realized it's because she's lonely. She doesn't have friends. She doesn't have a community. She does nothing for anyone else. And she's contrasting that with her sister, who's got a number of like psychological problems. But the people around her sister make her go volunteer at a soup kitchen with them, and they do all these other things. And she goes, and you know what? The sister complains every time she has to go do it, but she's changing. As mm-hmm. she's doing this, she's connecting with people. She's enjoying helping them, and it's bringing her something as well. It's changing her view of herself and who she is too. And that's all reflected in this movie also.
Yeah. Yeah. And, Jesus in, the Gospels, I can't remember which one, said, somebody asked him, what's the most important commandments?
Mm-hmm.
And he actually, you know, rather than saying all of them, he said,
yeah,
love God and love each other.
Yeah. Love God with all your heart and mind and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself.
Right. And I think that's what Bill Murray learns. You know, God is not mentioned in this, but when he stops fighting against the universe, I think that in a way is saying, I love God.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
So, yeah, he does both those things.
Yeah, because there's a power over him that he cannot change.
Mm-hmm.
And whether that's acknowledged outwardly, I hadn't thought about it in those terms exactly. But yeah, it's when you quit fighting against what you can't control and say, there's something that's in control that's not me. And that's this, I'm living Groundhog Day over and over. Who's doing that or why? We don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we pretty much know why. because when he finally gets to the point where he's who he should be, fulfilling his potential as a person, he's allowed out.
Yeah. Yep. And he is. And another interesting tidbit from that Tobolowsky Files is that almost final scene, or the scene where he breaks free. It was very important for Bill Murray to know the answer to, did I sleep with this woman or not?
Yeah. How am I dressed?
Yeah. How am I dressed?
No clothes on. Do I have the clothes from last night on? Yeah. He falls asleep with Andy McDowell, and the next morning he wakes up, and you see that he's out of it when her arm reaches across to turn the radio off.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, oh, feeling her arm like, oh. And the funny thing I thought was that the director and Andy McDowell had never thought of that.
Yeah, and how brilliant is that? Because it makes a huge difference.
You know?
I mean, how much different would the movie have been? Would we have been turned off? I think I would have a little bit.
Yeah.
Because, well, you know, it's like, oh, you know, because it was almost an existential modernist thing that, you know, the sexual pleasure, you know, or whatever, you know, it's something that we're inundated with. And once he had sex with the woman he wanted to have sex with, he broke out of this thing. You know, that would have been so much less effective or so much less meaningful to me.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that they did not, you know, makes it love that did it.
Right. They were soulmates.
Yeah.
So they didn't have to have that. That's late. That's for later, you know.
Right.
Yeah, that was actually perfect. And then I loved that it came down to, you know, the director had a vote, and it came down to the young woman who'd never worked on a film before who said, no, it has to be this way.
Oh, that, yeah. How cool was that?
Yeah. And I was like, and she's right. It would have been less. Mm-hmm. And then the other comment about that it had snowed outside overnight and they hadn't planned it, and the gate hadn't been shoveled out because they were supposed to go running out into the street, and he had to stop. And it wasn't, instead of stopping and going, oh, this is a problem, he just kind of improvised and lifted her over the gate, jumped over himself and went on. And he goes, and that's breaking the boundary. They're out. And I went, I never thought about that. But the symbolism is clear. We get it.
Yeah.
You know, they're free.
Right, right.
That's like also the symbolism that was brilliant that you mentioned earlier, the thing that he talks about in that podcast of, I never thought about the fact that if it's going to be the same day over and over, it has to be the same weather over. Mm,
that's right. Yeah. Yep.
And I never noticed the one little thing where he said it's not that way. But so they had to shoot every single scene in all sorts of weather. Sunshine, freezing, precipitation, overcast.
Yeah. And that was really an interesting thing, you know, just to imagine having to do that, you know, oh, it's sunny now. Like, get out there. Everybody get out there. Hurry.
We have to do all these scenes all. And so they were having to all really focus on working. But the thing it said to me was that made it more valuable was that Harold Ramis, the director, deliberately chose that overcast, gloomy, cold day to be the day he stuck in because that was the state of his heart.
Mm-hmm.
That was his internal state.
Yeah,
and then it starts to snow, and I never really picked up the fact that that's when time starts again. But then the next morning, it's sunny. The snow has fallen, but it's sunny and bright.
Yeah.
Because that's the new state of things.
Wow, and I was like, wow, that's brilliant. I hadn't connected all that. That's neat.
Yeah.
But yeah, the
symbolism, wow.
Right, so he had all these days to choose from in the can there, and he goes, yeah, this is the day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
How interesting. Yeah, just fascinating. Yeah, and you know, when you hear Tobolowsky in that DVD extra and you learn how, you know, their plans were changing, you know, as they were moving forward.
Yeah, they were rewriting on the last half as they went.
Right. The last movie that I remember seeing that, you know, I don't watch DVD extras on everything, but I love Pirates of the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm.
And the third movie... Well, actually, the second and the third, they kind of filmed at the same time, but they were writing that one as it was being filmed, and it ended up pretty much chaotic.
I was like, and it shows.
And it shows, exactly. And yet on this one, they just, you know, struck gold.
Yeah, it was
kind of amazing.
Serendipitous. They found what they needed. They were all in that groove.
Mm-hmm.
and I appreciate it.
Oh yeah, me too.
So and it's I also remarkable. Never thought about the fact that his weather reports that he does every morning, because they show quite a few of those when he's walking up to say, okay, here's what's happening with the groundhog. He has to keep doing that over and over. Here we are in Punxsutawney. What's gonna the groundhog gonna do? Those are actually like his journal reports.
Yeah, yeah, they are.
They give us his internal indicators for what's going to happen next. I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. It is. You know, the very first one he does, he's annoyed.
Yeah.
You know, and then he's pretty confused, you know, and then one day he doesn't even do it. He says, I'll just meet me at the restaurant. This doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And they're all flummoxed and yeah. Yeah.
And then he's bringing everyone coffee and asking people's opinion and being truly humble. And I think that's the thing. It comes back to that. At the end, what it is he has all these accomplishments that he would have loved to have at the beginning, but he would have used wrongly. But he's truly humble, which is to know your place. It's to know what you're good at, what you're bad at, and where those things stem from. Humility isn't being a doormat. It's, you know, oh, well, I am good at the piano, but she taught me. You know, it's that's for a Catholic, it's I get complimented on my voice a lot for podcasts. And I'm thinking always that is the best little reminder of humility ever. Thank you. I'm glad you enjoy the way I read it. I do that. But the voice, I have nothing to do with that. Mm-hmm. I was given that. And if I can read it because I happen to be able to read it in a way people like. Well, good. That's partly God-given and partly me using the gift I was given. So, okay, good. Thank you.
And yeah, that's what allows us to. Terrific way to look at that. Yep.
Well, and that's just really the definition of humility. I'm bad at other things. I wasn't given that, and I can't make myself get past it. And okay, I can't handle that. I'm not good at it, or these are my flaws. This is where I need help. And that's what allows you to ask for help, and it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not a reflection on you, which is part of it too.
I imagine it gives your life kind of a meaningful direction as well.
Yeah.
Because
don't you think so?
I do.
You
because
seem pretty humble in that way to me.
I don't know about that, but I just there's a lot of times where I feel like I'm being pulled in lots of different directions.
Mm-hmm.
And, trying to make the best decisions where, you know, this is what I want to spend my time doing is right. Sometimes a difficult thing, but, you know, I certainly haven't always done this, but doing it in humility is the way to do it.
Well, yeah. And I have trouble with humility. I always like to be the one who's giving my opinion and, you know, I mean, so, and my opinion's not always the most valuable. I know that. So shut up. Okay. That's a little flaw. There we go. But you are good or you, sorry, blah, blah, blah. You are doing some of the things that you really love, like directing those plays.
Mm-hmm.
And that is part of who you are. You were kind of built that way, you know, but you're giving so much to all the people around you by doing what you love, but doing it probably, I haven't seen one, with the proper perspective. Because you're willing to like have an assistant director on Little Women where your daughter was on it. And that allowed your daughter to have guidance from somebody that she wouldn't fight with kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay, that's smart on one hand, but it's also some people couldn't do it. Some people wouldn't be able to say, and I don't want to give you credit for something, but that's how it struck me when you told me that. I was like, oh, smart and willing to step aside for what's best for everybody, you know?
Well, thank you.
So if all your directing decisions are like that, then how lucky they are to have you.
Well, that's very, very nice of you to say that.
Well, it's
but that
just...
turned out really well. So that was, a good decision.
Yeah. Well, and that's, but you couldn't have made it if it was all about you. It wasn't all about you. It was about what was good for everybody in the play. You know, it was good for your daughter. It was good for everybody on it. And you don't know what people got from seeing it or what people got from participating in it. And that matters. Even in the little things, that matters. And so that's an example of humility. And it doesn't mean that, like I say, that word's been misused so much to where people think, oh, I have to be like a doormat, not say I'm good at anything. No, it's just what's proper perspective.
Yeah. And interesting.
Got it.
Yeah.
Yeah. on that anyway, for sure. We all have
places where we fall down. As for the rest of it, there are lots of problems. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, don't talk to my husband. But,
Oh, that's great. That's great. So yeah, I don't know that we have more to talk about this movie. I mean, do you have anything else that's coming to your mind?
No, because it's not. It's funny, for as much as we're saying it's deep, it's mm-hmm. not deeper than that.
Yeah.
But I think that's enough, because to be able to do that and get that message out in such an entertaining way that everybody has seen it probably more than once.
Mm-hmm.
What a wonderful, positive way to communicate that in a way that everybody remembers. And
yeah,
relates.
And that's it. You know, it's positive, it's uplifting, it's funny, and they came to the right conclusions.
Yeah. And you don't have to hit people over the head with something in order to make those points. How about that for a great message?
There you go.
You know,
that's rare.
A Christian movie maker would have put God into it everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, it can be done, but it's so rarely done gracefully.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
By saying that we don't know. And that's the other thing maybe that as a Catholic I love, there is mystery. We don't know who did it. We don't know why. I mean, we see the end result and we know why, I guess. It's for his benefit. Why was he important to do this for? We'll never know.
Mm-hmm.
Who did it? We assume it was God, because that's the big mystery. And you know what? Life is a mystery like that. We can't answer everything.
Yeah,
and I love that about it, too.
That is one of the things that I absolutely love about the Catholic Church, is that they're not afraid to say, well, you know what? That's a mystery.
Yeah.
You know, so many of the other churches have answers for every single thing, and it's important to them to know every step of everything. And the fact that God is who God is means that there has to be mystery. I mean, that's the only way that makes sense. We can't possibly understand everything.
Oh,
we just
can't.
Yeah, it's impossible.
Words fail.
Yeah, that's what the definition of God means, that there's no way I can understand him.
And if you know God well enough to be able to define him well, you're defining your own idea.
Mm-hmm.
So you've right then boxed him in.
Right.
And that's why you can read something by all these different people and it will all sound kind of different. It's like the blind man and the elephant, you know, where one man says it's a big wall because he's feeling his side. Another man says it's like a rope because he's feeling his tail. Well, that's the best we can do, is grasp to that little bit. I mean, I was reading I have this little daily devotional thing that's bits of Saint Teresa of Avila. I'm not sure how you say that. And yesterday she was saying something about how, oh, God is like water, and water does this and water does that. Water cleanses you and this. And then she suddenly just breaks away into a different metaphor, which was good because I was like, I've had it with the water. But she says, praying and getting an answer is like smelling something grilling in the distance.
Hmm.
Well, I just suddenly went, oh my gosh, that's brilliant, because who of us hasn't been taking a walk and suddenly gone, someone's having steak. Oh. And it's, boy, you know what it is. You don't know what kind of steak or how big, but boy, you get that recognition and you love it and you go, and then it's gone. But I was like, oh, that's those contacts with God. And you know, who thinks of describing God as grilling on a, you know, steak grilling or whatever?
Yeah, but that's interesting.
It's
neat.
Those little moments that other people give you where you go, I can use that because my own experiences I don't have words for.
Mm. Right, right.
Sometimes I could tell what happened, but there's nothing that really describes that feeling.
Right, yep. That's so true. You bet. All right. So what do we got coming up? Let's see.
Oh,
I'm looking this up here.
What do we have coming up? Let me think.
Your favorite book ever so far.
My favorite author who I've managed to avoid except for when I was forced to read The Red Pony and decided I would never open John Steinbeck ever again. Oh, wait. I got the book from the library yesterday. 600 pages of John Steinbeck.
John Steinbeck, yes. East of Eden by John Steinbeck is in 2 weeks.
Yeah. I'm not entirely bitter, everybody. I know good experiences are made from things that are forced upon you. I respect Scott's choices. And he's so much nicer than I am. I say, oh, guess what? Now we are going to read Jane Eyre. And he's like, oh, okay, that'll be great.
All right.
He's so nice. I am much more openly bitter.
And now I feel even worse because your next two picks are so cool that...
Well, they're not cool, but I would say that And Then There Were None is the book is super lightweight reading, but it's got a lot to it.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to that.
Inception, a friend of mine feels about Inception the way I feel about John Steinbeck.
Hmm.
So if you don't already like it, I've seen it.
Yeah.
Oh, I figured. I think you told me you'd seen it, but I was just thinking of. It's funny how different things grab people, and that's why, although I'm complaining because it's funny and kind of true, I'm also not fighting it because I would have felt that way about Uncle Tom's Cabin or A Tale of Two Cities if you forced them on me and I hadn't come across them on my own, and I love those two books.
Mm-hmm.
So this, I'm very well prepared to find, will open my eyes and be a great reading experience. I just have to complain up front because I'm... not always nice and gracious. I'm a lot of times bitter and mean.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
All right. So, and then I went ahead and selected my next two, which is, well, we're getting way out there. September the 8th is Contact, the movie with Jodie Foster. And September 22nd is a book, Declare by Tim Powers, which is a book that neither of us have read yet. So it is kind of a risk, but it's been highly recommended.
Yeah.
And I like Tim Powers, so we're going to go for that.
And I have never been able to finish one of his books, so thanks, Jeff Miller.
You bet. And here I am giving you that one, too.
But he won't be Steinbeck.
That book is only 1,100 pages long.
What?
No, I'm joking. It's a joke.
Oh, thank you for stopping me before I got really ugly here in front of everybody. No, actually, I could probably take that from Tim Powers easier than the thought of reading Steinbeck. Isn't that sad?
You'll have to put the audio on fast forward.
Well, and the thing with Tim Powers, it's not that I've tried his books, and it's not that I couldn't finish one. It's just that I would get halfway through and go, I just don't care enough. Mm-hmm. You know, all these things are happening, and I can keep track of them, and I understand where it's going. He just never hooked me. So I'm curious to see if I'm really pushed to finish one, if there's a point past that.
Mm-hmm.
And this book may not have that point for me. I may love the whole thing.
Okay.
But if there's a point past that where I go, oh, wait, it grabbed me or something.
Well, cool.
Because they always start off very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, they all do.
So it's science fiction. I'm more inclined to give it a chance. So I haven't been burned by that as much as I have by regular fiction.
Gotcha. Let's see. I'm just looking up the description. It says, this supernatural suspense thriller crosses several genres, espionage, geopolitics, religion, and fantasy. But like the chicken crossing the road, it takes quite a while to get to the other side. That's from actually a review. So
I know. I'm just like, oh, okay.
So that's what we're doing. This should be fun. Yep.
Yeah, I know. That'll be good. And then... I'm not going to choose anything until mine are closer to being done since we're already so far out there and I want to be flexible in case it comes up. But
I wanted to go the science fiction route on this next round. So I said, oh, yeah. So I went ahead and picked.
So September. Ooh. I get October.
Yes.
Oh, this is going to be great. Oh, my gosh. The possibilities. Bradbury or Kuntz.
Oh,
or
very
Stephen
cool.
King. Oh, y'all.
Oh, love
this. It's going to be great.
Fantastic.
Oh, yeah. Oh, thank you for letting me
know. I might recommend some John Steinbeck for October.
Oh, well, I am living October in August or July, I guess I could say. It's an early Halloween for me. The horror.
No fun.
Then the picture with my, my hands up to my face and my face like,
oh. Oh, good.
She read about Kathy and the horror got worse. I just want to say there's some awful, awful people in this book.
And some good ones. But
yes,
you may
I just
not
have
found them yet.
I guess I have met a couple of good people.
That's good.
But But the horrible people are so horrible. Okay, now I'm going to stop because actually it's quite well written and quite interesting in the story he's telling. And even though it's multi-generational, another thing I don't like. You hit every button.
Oh, how funny. I love it. This will be a great talk.
I know. I looked at it like, oh, multi-generational. Great. Yeah, so I'm sure I'll be humble and apologize in this.
Or maybe not. Or maybe not.
Well, I'm already happier than I... No, I guess I really liked that Denzel Washington movie up to the very end, too. So
sure, okay. Sure.
Yeah, so...
All right.
Did we have anything extra that we wanted
to... Yeah, you know what I wanted to... I think I'll just bring up one movie that I really love, but I don't see us doing in this podcast because I can't think of a depth to it, but... I was just watching a movie the other day called Sneakers by, it's got Robert Redford, and it is one of my favorite movies of all time.
Really?
But I can't think of a reason to talk about it on our podcast, other than it's awesome and go see it. It's great. It's a kind of a heist type of a movie.
Okay.
Robert Redford and River Phoenix is in it. And
who I love.
Dan Aykroyd is in it. Another Saturday Night Live alum. And these guys are from different walks of life, and they've formed a company that does things, you know, at the beginning of the movie, they're breaking into a bank to prove that it can be broken into. They've been hired by the owners of the bank to break into the bank because the owners want to know if it can be done. So that's kind of what they do for a living. And somebody approaches them, wanting them to steal a encryption device. And so they do, and then it gets all tangled up. Terrific movie. Absolutely. Ben Kingsley's in it.
I remember it when it was advertised. Isn't it like a red sneaker or something? No, wait. Nope. That's a Jeff Goldblum movie.
Yeah. This one's just called Sneakers, right?
Yeah, but I remember seeing that when it advertised and it came out. I just never saw it. Okay, I've written that down. And then let's
really good movie.
Since you talked about a movie... I believe I will also say a movie that I don't, it might have the depth, in which case I was completely blind, but I saw the new version of True Grit last weekend.
Yes.
And I never watched the old movie because I just didn't care about that. Glenn Campbell and Kim Darby just didn't grab me. And, but it was great. This is the Coen Brothers direction, Jeff Bridges, as is his new persona. He was playing, you know, the drunk reprobate Rooster Cogburn, and I'm thinking of Crazy Heart when I say that.
Gotcha.
And and Matt Damon, who, oh my gosh, does that guy have range or what? But he plays the Texas Ranger, and that's about a 14-year-old girl who, she's terrific, and I'm sorry I can't remember her name because she's, I think, fairly new on the movie scene. Her father is gunned down and stolen from in cold blood in the Old West, and she's determined to see justice done. So, ignoring the letters from her mother telling her to come home, she went and was arranging for the father's body to be sent back, but she takes the money that was left from her father, and she hires Rooster Cogburn, who's a federal marshal, to go find the guy who did it and kill him or bring him back to be hung. And she wants to go with him to make sure it's done. She's a very forceful personality. And Matt Damon is the Texas Ranger who's been on this guy's track for a long time because he's done a lot of other bad things. So they wind up trying to find him. And I didn't expect it to be funny. You know, it was very gritty, very realistic. Although, even though it's the Coen brothers, there are a couple of flashes of horrific violence, but they're really fast. So although we all jumped and gasped, it was kind of done. And it was good in the way of, like, when they said, that's a 300-yard shot, they showed you kind of how that looked to them. So you're like, I'm not sure how they're even sure that is that person. So it was really good that way. And then the dialogue was just hilarious. Always kind of underlying. But, like, at one point, they're sitting around a campfire and Matt Damon's going, well, if I could tell you the times that I've drunk water out of a muddy hoof print and been glad to have it, and Rooster Cogburn, Jeff Bridges' character, says, Oh, yeah. I've met 25 Texas Rangers, and all of them have lapped water out of a muddy hoof print. If I ever meet one that doesn't, I'm going to shake his hand and give him a cigar. And Matt Damon's like, hey, it's true. And he goes, well, it could be. It could be that's part of their code. You know, for all I know, is you have to lap water out of a muddy hoof print to be a Texas Ranger. So it's just this, and then it goes on.
Oh, funny.
So it was a very good drama.
Well, good. Yeah, I need to watch that. That's one that I've been meaning to watch but haven't.
Yeah, and Sneakers, I've heard it recommended before and just never. Good. So, okay.
Yep. Enjoy.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody. We'll see stay you cool. in a couple of weeks. Yeah, stay cool. Yep. Turn on your air conditioner.
Yeah. And, yeah, stay inside. Eat some ice cream.
All good advice.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, bye. Everybody. We'll see you. Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye. Thank you.